From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. We don't sound like any other radio program or podcast because we're not like any other radio program or podcast. Our slogan for almost 15 years of broadcasting is Religion and Radio Done Differently. Thanks for listening. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can do it today. Why not right now? This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, some prominent American Catholic faith leaders are challenging claims that abortion politics mean the faithful cannot vote for Joe Biden. It's important to remember that unlike many dogmatic evangelical traditions, core Catholic teaching has always stressed personal responsibility on a number of moral issues, not simplistic either-or litmus tests. Bishop Robert McElroy of San Diego says, "One very sad dimension of the election cycle we're witnessing is the public denial of candidates' identity as Catholics because of a specific policy position they have taken. Such denials are injurious because they reduce Catholic social teaching to a single issue. But they are offensive because they constitute an assault on the meaning of what it is to be Catholic." Joe Biden's running mate, Kamala Harris, was clear on the attacks on the candidate's faith in a Wednesday interview with Rachel Maddow.
"First of all, I love Joe Biden. He's such a good person, and he is so deep of faith and an incredible optimist in the midst of all that we are seeing. And I'm going to say, I think it's hurtful to Joe, to be honest. He goes to Mass every Sunday. For him, his faith is a part of him. And, you know, I think that Joe feels the way most people do, which is that their relationship with God and their relationship with their faith is something that cannot be tarnished by other people's perceptions of who they are."
Meanwhile, a new Pew Research poll shows white Christian support for Donald Trump has declined since August. While he still holds majority support among white non-evangelical Protestants, the number is down from 59% to 53%. And among white Catholics, his lead over Joe Biden has shrunk from 19% to 8%. Even among the base of his base, white evangelical Protestants, 83%, has turned into 78%. Meanwhile, among black Protestant voters, Joe Biden has 90% support. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
"And do you believe that climate change is happening and it's threatening the air we breathe and the water we drink?"
Senator, that is on a very contentious matter of public debate, and I will not do that. I will not express a view on a matter of public policy, especially one that is politically controversial."
"Do you agree with Justice Scalia's view that Roe can and should be overturned by the Supreme Court?"
"I can't express views on cases or pre-commit to approaching a case any particular way."
"Do you believe that every president should make a commitment unequivocally and resolutely to the peaceful transfer of power?"
"Well, Senator, that seems to me to be pulling me in a little bit into this question of whether the president has said that he would not peacefully leave office. And so to the extent that this is a political controversy right now, as a judge, I want to stay out of it.
Do you think that the president has the power to pardon himself for any past or future crimes he may have committed against the United States of America?
That's not one that I can answer.
You've been candid to this body about who you are, what you believe.
I don't know if you've spent much time watching the hypocritical Senate confirmation hearings for Donald Trump's desperately rushed Supreme Court nominee, but Amy Coney Barrett has pointedly refused to answer a number of questions at the core of what she would be called to rule on in her first weeks on the bench. Frank Schaefer grew up in a powerful theocratic American dynasty and is well equipped to recognize the dangers of this mentality. He's warning of how much of it he sees in Barrett in every way he knows, including later on this week's State of Belief.
People at this moment in time in the United States are very open to the idea that the United States has not faced up to that racist, shameful, criminal past. And because we haven't faced up to it, we had a tremendous backlash to the presidency of Barack Obama that produced Donald Trump.
Dr. Susan Nyman is director of the Einstein Forum in Potsdam, Germany. A moral philosopher, cultural commentator, and scholar, she's the author of Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil, a deeply insightful book and a very timely one. And I look forward to meeting this author on this week's show. But first,
I noticed that I was having a bunch of similar conversations with my white girlfriends, and they were having like a similar theme come up. And that theme was that they were telling me that they had been raised in ways that made it very difficult for them to be reliable allies.
Even as the distractions in these last days before Election Day mount, a group of women leaders are working to maintain a laser focus on what's at stake on November 3rd. The Ally Virtual Tour is presenting a series of online events every Monday in October, confronting questions of race, gender, and faith. And I am delighted to have the organizer, Lisa Sharon Harper, with us today. Lisa, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I'm actually really excited to be here again. Thank you.
Describe what the Ally Virtual Tour is all about, please.
Well, the Ally Virtual Tour brings together seven women who are all of Christian faith and very diverse. Between us, it's white, Latino, and African American. And we are asking the critical questions of what it looks like for us to be an ally with each other in such a critical year as 2020, particularly when our electorate is as divided as it is, the most divided it's been since the Civil War, since the years before the Civil War and definitely the Civil War itself. And we are asking the tough questions. So we began with the very question of truth itself, since one of the first actions of President Trump when he came into office was to question the very reality of truth, claiming that there are alternative facts and alternative truth. And that over the course of the last 4 years has left confusion, the same kind of confusion that actually creates fertile ground for authoritarian rulers to grow and take root. And then the second week, we talked about the wedge issue that has wedged our nation apart for the last 40 years, the question of abortion and LGBTQ rights and equality. And we went there. We instead of playing inside of the frameworks that were handed to us in 1983 by the religious right and the moral majority, the framework of pro-life versus pro-choice, we decided to blow that up. And actually, instead of having a wartime either or enemy and friend framework, to have a human framework to talk about this question of abortion in the light of reproductive health and in the light of women's actual experiences, human experiences of having to make these choices, and also looking at how the church has counseled women and can and is counseling women to this day, so who are actually dealing with these issues. So what does that look like to work that through through a lens of our actual faith in Jesus? And then the third conversation that we're having is the conversation on white power versus women's power, because what we've seen at work in the United States over the last several years since Trump has been in office, it's become very clear the ways that white men, who generally hold the majority of the power in the United States of America and in most Western countries, they have a lockdown on that power. And women only get to share in that power in as much as they help to protect it. And so we are asking the question, how does our capacity to ally with each other shift, change, expand when we move the sensibilities of those white men from the center to the circle, along with everybody else, equalizing, making the sensibilities that we care about more equitable? How does that increase our capacity to become allies with each other? Not just allies in terms of trying to win a rule or a law or a policy, but rather allies for each other's health and flourishing. And the final week, the 26th of October, all of these are on Monday nights starting at 7:30 and going till 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in the United States. The final conversation will be, what will radical friendship, the kind of friendship that Ruth and Naomi had in the scripture, what does that require of us on Election Day and every day after?
Would you mind telling us the names of the other women?
So it's Jen Hatmaker, who is an online, just extraordinaire. She leads an online community of literally millions. She's a former TV, reality TV show star, and has written several bestseller, New York Times bestseller books. So she is one of the first people that I called when I got this idea. And she immediately said, I'm in. Didn't even, before the end of the call, she was like, yes. The next person is Nadia Bowles-Weber, who is also a dear friend and located in the Denver area of the United States. And she has an incredible following. She's a pastor, a Lutheran pastor, and is known for her ways of having very deeply rooted faith, rooted in the scripture, rooted in practice, but also not accepting of the normal way that we look at things. She always has another angle, which I love. She forces us to consider the human angle of the curt answers that we've come to expect when we talk about these deep questions. So I invited her into this conversation. She's also had a real process herself. And what does it look like to be an ally? Another of our white sisters who are in the conversation is Kirsten Powers, who is a pundit on CNN with Anderson Cooper on his show. She's there almost every week, talking with him about the issues of the day. She formerly was at Fox News and transferred over to CNN several years ago. She also has a regular column in USA Today. So she really understands Washington, D.C. She understands politics. And she also has an incredible foot in both worlds, both the conservative world and also the progressive world. So she's able to look at things from multiple perspectives and comes from an evangelical background. And then finally, our last white panelist is Sarah Holland. So Sarah Stewart Holland is a former Politico. She worked on Capitol Hill and worked in one of the presidential campaigns, and is now actually one of the co-hosts of Pantsuit Politics, that brings together herself and Beth Silvers, who do not share the same point of view on every little thing, but they are able to have conversation. And so we invited Sarah Holland into the conversation to add political perspective. She specifically is in our weeks 2 and 3, while Nadia is in our weeks 1 and 4. And then the women of color who have joined me are my mentor, longtime mentor, Brenda Salter McNeil, Reverend Dr. Brenda Salter McNeil, I should say, who is based in Seattle, previously Chicago, and is the author of several books, including her most recent, Becoming Brave. And she is really, she's like one of the foremost racial reconciliation, racial justice consultants in the United States with regard to the church, really more than anything focused on the evangelical church. And then finally, Alexia Salvatierra, who is one of the foremost organizers, particularly in the area of immigration reform and asylum seekers. She was one of the original founders of the New Sanctuary Movement in America, and is helping to pioneer a new effort called Matthew 25, Mateo 26, that is bringing together white churches and immigrant churches to be able to partner in fighting for immigrant rights in California. And that's a pilot that is being looked at throughout the rest of the country. So, and then of course myself. So it's you can see this is an incredible group of women that have come together. Yeah. And we do not all see the same on all things. We really do hold a spectrum of thought. And that was actually demonstrated even in our last conversation on abortion and LGBTQ. We had real pushback even within our conversation, but ultimately we were able to have the kind of conversation that listened, that leaned in, and actually influenced each other.
Lisa, you have a long career in training leaders and activists in the work of justice. Why did you decide this would be the most effective way to raise up the issues that you see as key in this election year?
That's such a great question. I think that one of the prime pieces of data that influenced my decision to launch the Ally Tour was what happened on November, I think it was November 3rd, 2016, but basically on Election Day, 2016, that next morning at 3:30 in the morning when President Trump took the podium and declared that he had won, and we heard that Hillary Clinton had lost, according to the Electoral College. When that happened, there was something that it just clarified in my view. I understood for the first time that America has two very potent, very strong, competing narratives of who it is and how we got here. That the narrative that won, according to the Electoral College in 2016, was the narrative that we were once great and we need to become great again. And when I actually stood at the line for the Republican convention in 2016, and along with nuns on the bus, I was the first non-nun to be on the bus. and I was there with them just to support. And we did surveys that day of the delegates that were going in to the convention hall for the Republican convention. And we asked them, when would you say America was great? And by and large, most of the people that I talked to said America was great before the New Deal. Okay, so just take that in. Before taxes, before people who are rich were asked to contribute to the common pot, before America saw itself as a commons, as brother having responsibility for your brother and sister having responsibility for your sister. That's when they say America was great. And it just so happens that that time absolutely coincides when the time when white men ruled with impunity. That was literally the time when we had the most race riots in America, the 19-teens, 1920s, literally whole black towns were razed to the ground, burned to the ground, more lynchings in that area and also the two previous decades before than at any point in American history. And so there was an absolute sense of white male rule. Now that changed with the civil rights movement. There was a huge pushback against that. And so the other competing narrative is the narrative of the Obama campaign and the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Biden campaign, right? So there's a And that other clear narrative is the narrative that America has never actually fully lived up to its ideals. And so our role and our goal is always to become a more perfect union. That's where the quote progressive vision comes from. And so these two narratives, one that understands that we have never lived up to that ideal of understanding that all humanity is created and endowed by their creator with the inherent immutable right to happiness and life and liberty. There is not anyone of color in America who would say that, yes, we've realized, I shouldn't say that. There are few people in America that would say, yes, we have fully realized that.
The virtual tour continues on the 19th and 26th of October. How do people tune in?
Actually, you go to theallytour.com, and that's where you get your tickets. And the videos are shown both on that website, but also on Facebook. So if you have a Facebook account, you can actually sign up for our private Facebook group. And when you sign up, you gain access to all four conversations, even the ones that have previously happened, all the way through the end of the year. So you can watch them at your own discretion.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic about what's next for our nation?
I am optimistic because we are having the conversations we are having right now, and we're not the only ones having them. The reason we are in the moment we're in is we have not had these conversations before. But because we are having these hard conversations now publicly, we actually have an opportunity to help America to bridge our narrative gap, the gap that exists between our narratives.
A senior fellow at Auburn Theological Seminary, Lisa Sharon Harper, is the author of numerous books, including The Very Good Gospel, How Everything Wrong Can Be Made Right, and Evangelical Does Not Equal Republican or Democrat. Every Monday in October, Lisa and her fellow women leaders are conducting the Ally Virtual Tour in preparation for this year's election. Lisa, thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's really an honor.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, the author of a challenging new book, Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil, Dr. Susan Nyman. And later, author and activist Frank Schaefer, who says that Barrett nomination is even more dangerous than it looks. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. While the loudest battles over Confederate monuments and other symbols of a lost bloody war have gone dormant, the impulses behind them have not. No one is more triggered by the widespread protests to unwarranted extrajudicial killing of black Americans today than the supposed proud sons of the South. Which is why it can be exceedingly difficult to focus on the need for atonement and healing, never mind reparations, while this administration relentlessly acknowledges their very fine peopleness and few of us know what is yet to come. Of course, there is no comparison between the atrocities of Third Reich Germany and today's polarized but mostly peaceful United States. But the impulse toward demonizing political enemies and scapegoating of perceived evildoers among one's neighbors is more than dangerous enough, which is what makes Dr. Susan Nyman's work and her latest book, Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil, so important. The author joins us now from Potsdam, Germany, where she is the longtime head of the Einstein Forum. Susan, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
No, pleasure to be with you.
As I'm sure you could tell just now, I, like many others, struggle to find ways to talk about Nazi Germany in relation to the present day. While your focus is on the aftermath of national atrocities, I wonder if you could suggest a credible way to do that without people reflexively turning away.
Well, the interesting thing is that when I first began my research on my book, Learning from the Germans, it was a very provocative title. And Americans were, understandably, who've been brought up with a rather simple picture of Nazi Germany as absolute evil. People were reluctant and, disturbed by the analogy. I must say, by the time the book was published last fall, and I did a long book tour, and we had seen, as you quoted, out of the White House, someone praising Nazis as very fine people, nobody was shocked by my title in that three-year period. And lest we use the word neo-Nazi, I think that's a cheap exit. Those people who were brandishing swastikas, which are forbidden in today's Germany, and torches, and wearing T-shirts with Hitler quotes, and using the expression blood and soil, which is a Nazi expression, that's Nazis. That's not neo-Nazis. Those are Nazis. So that's the first thing. One, thing that I think is, and of course there are all kinds of differences between slavery and the age of neo-slavery, which I think is wrongly called Jim Crow. That's a way of prettifying what actually took place, and you have wonderful work like Brian Stevenson's National Lynching Memorial in Alabama that have showed us just exactly how awful the time after slavery was. But my book begins by pointing out all the differences, and of course there are many differences. No two histories are the same. What most struck me in my research were some similarities, and they were the similarities between most Germans at the end of World War II and people who defend the lost cause. Now, this is really was even quite a shock for me, because it is not something that Germans talk about. They will tell you that their parents were Nazis or their grandparents, and that they're ashamed of them, and that, many places, family structures were really thoroughly destroyed when the children grew up and realized what their parents had done. A very, very, tenuous, difficult relationships with their parents. I think because we think of Nazis in a very demonic sort of way, we tend to think that the minute the war was over, they all got down their knees and begged for atonement. But actually, most of them thought they were the war's worst victims. And they would talk about the fact that their country had been partly dismembered, their cities were in ruins and ashes, their men, if they survived, were in prisoner of war camps, the children were hungry, and on top of that, those damn Yankees wanted to make out that it was their fault that the war happened. And what I understood by looking at those litanies is that people, of course, always think about their own suffering first. And the Germans did suffer in the aftermath of the war, no question about it. 7 million people dead, cities absolutely destroyed, about a third of the country lost. So what I think is, it's natural. We all want our people to be heroes. We want our parents to be heroes. We want our country folk to be heroes. And if
something happens so that we can't see them as heroes anymore, the second thing we do is to think of them as victims. We say, well, they would have been heroes if they could have, but history made them victims. And you see that move in post-war Germany, as well as still often among a certain kind of Southerner. What the Germans did that was historically unique is to make the further move, which was to say, yes, we fought and we suffered a lot after we lost the war, but other people suffered more and it was our fault. And that's a move that I really think Americans can learn from, because once you acknowledge that you were really the cause of a vast amount of suffering, and you do something to atone for it, it's painful. But what the German people have been going through in the last 40, 50 years has actually made them a much better, stronger, and surprisingly, even a happier country. It wasn't easy. And, you know, to my friends in the South, I spent quite a lot of time in Mississippi when I was researching this book, learning from people, black and white, in the South who are trying to work on racial reconciliation and getting people to acknowledge the really painful history of our country. They actually found hope in that because, of course, they know how much pushback they get for asking people to acknowledge unpleasant truths. But when you see that it's completely natural, and that even former Nazis did that for a long time, you can say, well, okay, our country's taking some steps, and of course there are people who push back against it, but we can come through this.
I'd like for you, if you would, because you've given us great insight into why the lessons of Germany have application to present-day America. And even if there is some redundancy here, I wish you would just say to our listeners, what are the key lessons that we need to learn from Germany and through your important book?
So, first of all, the Germans, they like long compound words. So they have a concept which I translate as working off the past or working through the past. And it's not one simple, single process. What it really involves is facing a new and truer historical narrative. Again, we'd all really rather have a, you know, heroic narrative of our country, but it's, you know, just simply wasn't true. So it involves a new narrative, and the narrative is something that needs to be, of course, taught in schools. You know, people need to rethink the way history is taught. And there's a good American organization called Facing History, whose purpose really is to provide materials for a different curriculum about American history. And they're very serious, good people. So if anybody's interested, they should look at their website. It's called Facing History. But education doesn't begin or end in school, as we know. And popular culture needs to be examined as well. We need different kinds of films. We need different kinds of songs. We need to look at the songs that we sing. We need to think about our iconography. And, of course, that battle is taking place in the United States over public monuments. One thing that I think people get wrong about the monuments discussion is it gets polarized into this question, well, is it history or is it hate? I don't think it's either one. I mean, of course, it is history. But we don't memorialize every piece of our history. You know, you don't build a monument to your Aunt
Mildred. Unless you did something absolutely special, you might keep a picture of her in your living room. But we pick and choose the people who we decide to build monuments to. And we pick them because they represent values that we want our children to honor and our communities to respect. And I think once you get that, I certainly understand people who defend, you know, the Johnny Reb statues and everything else by saying, well, I don't feel any hate in my heart for Black people. And I believe them. I'm sure that that's true. But what they're overlooking there is that those monuments are not just simple history. They represent values. When New Orleans Mayor Landrieu took down those statues in New Orleans, he made a beautiful speech, some of which I quoted in my book. But I think there was one thing he didn't get quite right. He said he thought of the Lee Monument from the perspective of a 10-year-old Black girl walking by that statue and feeling he wasn't there to inspire or encourage her, and he didn't want that to happen. And I think that's fine, but I think you need to add, I don't want a 10-year-old white boy walking by that statue and thinking that's the kind of man I'm supposed to be, you know? And that is the message, of course, that little white boys were getting every time they walked by a Confederate general or a Johnny Reb statue. So, you know, rethinking, first of all, which monuments ought to be put in museums, but particularly thinking about who we want to put in their place is a very important part of this, you know, this process. My hope is that, you know, communities will take it on themselves to do this in a most, you know, the most possibly democratic way, small d there, democratic way as possible, and really talk about which values they want their communities to honor in the 21st century. And, you know, that's a way in which communities can both learn about their own history and learn about and, you know, think about values. I was actually born and grew up in Atlanta. And my mother was involved in the school desegregation campaign. So I kind of grew up in the middle of the civil rights movement. But I had no idea when those statues were built until 2015, when people began to talk about them. You know, I assumed, I think like most of us did, well, they were just put up right after the war and, you know, people wanted to remember their fallen heroes. But of course, it was part of an orchestrated campaign, and that's very important that we learn that. Mm-hmm. So if you are trying to, you know, work through a difficult past, there's not one recipe. You know, even before the virus, I was saying, you know, it's not a vaccine. It's not a one-shot thing. And lately I've been thinking maybe it's like a flu vaccine. You know, it's something that you have to get a repeated number of times, because just simply saying, okay, I acknowledge that much of U.S. history has flaunted white superiority over African Americans and Native Americans in ways that, you know, we shouldn't have done, just shouldn't have done.
We're talking about issues that involve reconciliation and atonement. I'm not even sure that that matters to a lot of the people. There seems to be, in fact, a gleefulness to the tensions rather than the kind of suffering of seeing evil in the conflict rather than in the supposed opposition. It feels like at times the worst is yet to come in this country. What led the Germans to undertake the work of self-examination and of learning from that?
Well, it was a number of things, and it was different in the two parts of Germany. In East Germany, the leadership was really anti-fascist. The East German leadership had survived the war either in exile or in concentration camps. So you had good leadership on one side, largely. I know most Americans don't know anything about that, but it's true. On the other side, it was a question of time. It was a question of, accounts coming out of survivors. People, of course, in the first couple of decades just wanted to repress what they had done. And it wasn't until you had literature, you had movies, there were church groups who were active, some writers and artists. And I think there was a sense of shame when Germans realized how they were seen in the eyes of other people, in the eyes of other countries. That was certainly played a role. And I'm sorry to say, since I do live in a different country, I see how other people have been looking at the United States in the last 4 years, and they are shocked and saddened by kinds of things that you refer to. There, America has lost, in the eyes of much of the world, lost its leadership function as a place. I can't tell you how many people have said to me, but America's supposed to uphold democracy. What are they doing? You know, we looked up to them for a long, long time. We do not have national leadership right now that will get us out of that mess.
We're coming up on an election that is already divisive and may take us farther down the road negatively. Is there one lesson we need to learn from the Germans that would help us get into this election and get out of it with some promise?
Well, care about truth. Look at your sources of information. Do not rely on one single source of information. Do not rely on social media. Inform yourself. And do not demonize people who look or think differently from you. I would say those are the most important lessons that we can learn.
Dr. Susan Nyman is a moral philosopher, cultural commentator, and essayist. She's been the director of the Einstein Forum in Potsdam, Germany, since 2000. Her many, many books include Moral Clarity, A Guide for Grown-Up Idealists, and most recently, Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. Susan, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It was a pleasure.
Frank Schaefer is a persuasive activist and articulate author and a very angry former member of the culture war-waging political religious right. His prolific writings, often in the form of well-informed warnings about theocratic threats to our government and our culture, are well worth following, and unsurprisingly, his recent focus has been on the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the highest court in the land. Frank, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hey, thank you for having me on again.
Somehow, Senate Republicans made the nominee's extremist religious views off limits this week, even as the president and his minions ridicule the faith of Joe Biden. What should have been discussed in terms of Barrett's post associations?
Well, I have a few points to make here. One is a general point that religious folks on the right or the left who hide behind their religion to propose political views, as in, don't criticize my beliefs, now you're criticizing my religion, I have a right to believe what I want, is a dodge that has been used for a long time by evangelicals, Roman Catholics, Muslims, Hindus, you name it, in order to avoid criticism of sometimes horrible activity. You see right now, just to show that I'm not just talking about America here, in India, you have an Indian nationalist Hindu party, which is saying that India is for Hinduism, that Muslims are no longer welcome and are going to be marginalized, that Christian missionaries are being arrested and kicked out. You have an Islamic party in Saudi Arabia that has exported a harsh view of Islam worldwide and then says that one doesn't have a right to criticize that, that you're an Islamophobe or anti-Islamic if you point out that the Wahhabist cult pushed by the royal family for political reasons is not traditional Islam. And we have the same thing here in the States. Now, with Amy Coney Barrett, there's a difference because the Roman Catholic faith is one source of her belief system when it comes to things like being against abortion. But she has been raised in, part of, and a leader in, and her whole family has been immersed in, including her mother and father, a very off-the-wall, little evangelical-inspired Roman Catholic ecumenical evangelical group called People of Praise that even by evangelical standards is off the charts. For instance, they assign a woman to give guidance and leadership to other women that they call a handmaid. That woman is given the authority to advise and tell women who they can marry, what kind of underwear to wear, things as minute as an unmarried woman can't wear a large belt buckle with a pair of jeans or slacks because it draws too much attention to her crotch. Things most Americans would find amusing, but that, let's just say, if she was a Scientologist and a movie star in Hollywood and had been appointed to some government position or some other member of another kind of a cult well known for abusing its members, this would be fair game. So with Amy Coney Barrett, there's really two issues. There's the hypocrisy of Christians or any other religious group hiding behind either religious freedom, separation of church and state, or somehow personal belief being above criticism to push a political agenda that has nothing to do with their faith, has everything to do with imposing their faith on other unwilling participants. For instance, women who want access to abortion or women who want access to contraceptives and would be denied that by someone like Amy Coney Barrett, who doesn't believe that health insurance should provide contraceptive coverage and will enforce that if given the chance. Or all the rest of us who look at her statements about climate change, where she says, I'm not a scientist, this is a political issue, I can't comment on it. Mirroring exactly what big oil, big coal, and their foundations have said for years. These are not religious beliefs. These are political beliefs, and that they are based in a form of religious faith has to be brought up. So the government, the media, simply don't do their job if they're not willing to go there. And in her case, also being a leader in an offshoot cult, a very weird cult by most people's definition, makes it totally fair game. There's absolutely no reason we shouldn't go there. And I'll conclude this sort of lengthy answer with one more point. She's made a point in the last few days of the hearings of pretending to have no fixed political views at all. Oh, well, this is beyond what I can talk about hypothetically. I'm not a scientist, so I can't address this issue. This case hasn't come before me, so we'll have to see. And yet she comes out of the Federalist Society and a whole group of evangelical and Roman Catholic Christians who have had a 30-year project, not hidden, not secret, above the board, open, to lace the courts with ultra-far-right conservative justices cast in the mold of Antonin Scalia or even more conservative than that in order to remake big chunks of American society that they want to change. For instance, they want to roll back gay marriage. They want to roll back transgender rights. They want to roll back the access to contraceptives that women have through insurance companies. That's why they attack the ACA. And yet here she presents herself as having no views. So in addition to everything else, she has branded herself from the very beginning here, someone willing to lie by omission or even directly saying she doesn't have a view, when her own writing for the last 20 years of scholarship back up the fact that she's an ultra-conservative Roman Catholic on one hand, and then someone who has gone the next step and joined a very cultic-like controlling group that above all has had one point they've tried to make. And that is an anti-feminist point that says women have to submit to their husbands, that God has put men in charge. So that this isn't just a matter of Roe v. Wade. Her view, borne out by the fact that she spent the last 20 years or longer in a Christian group that has as its calling card the subjugation of women to male authority, puts her on the side of rolling back some of the most progressive things that have happened in our country in terms of women's rights. And she comes from a day when women used to vote the way their husbands told them to. She comes from a day when women did not have careers. And so there's a huge hypocrisy here because she has a career. She has authority outside the home. I presume that even though she belongs to a group that officially says you're under your husband's guidance and authority, she will make her own decisions on the Supreme Court. So she reminds me of an earlier anti-feminist activist, Phyllis Schlafly, who used to go around telling women to go back to their kitchen, as it were, live the stereotypical life, and yet at the same time put together a huge national organization to stop the Equal Rights Amendment, and certainly did act like nothing except a woman leader, which of course was great, but not when hypocritically she was preaching another form of subjugation to women. So Tony Barrett is a real threat, and she has been planted here by the Federalist Society that has groomed her. She has 3 years of experience on the bench and is going to be put there precisely because of her ideological beliefs, which she now is on the stand under oath denying that she even has. And so this is a real step backward for America.
When religious freedom was raised at the hearings again and again, it was framed in terms favored by the religious right. Democratic views, indeed the views of an overwhelming majority of Americans, were marginalized or ignored. What does that tell us about how far we have come and where we are?
Well, I would take a slightly different approach, maybe to one that you're expecting. I wish she would come out and be straightforward and honest. And it wouldn't make me support her, but I would respect her at that point. For instance, if she said, you are absolutely right, my religious faith informs my view of abortion, and I am going to work hard to roll back Roe v. Wade that I think was badly decided on two bases, as law, which has given us 40 years near of social conflict, and on the other hand, it contravenes what I believe. When it comes to women, I do believe that women should submit to their husbands. I live that way with my husband. We have a friendly partnership and have made it work. That's who I am. Why should I leave my beliefs at the door when I enter the court? Let's get real here. We all have philosophical presuppositions, whether they're secular or religious. Why should anybody have to abandon what they believe to be true, to be right, and to be moral when they are appointed a justice or run for office? Enough with this hypocrisy. I am who I am. Deal with it. Guess what? She would have my respect at that point. I would disagree with every single thing I put in her mouth right now as a view. But I would say, at least we're not dealing with a liar cast in the mold of Donald Trump who says one thing and does another. So I think religious people should come out and be forthright. And then when their religion is criticized in terms of their views, if someone argues with what that belief is, say on the basis of science, when it comes to climate change denial, or the basis of gynecological information and ultrasounds when it comes to the development of fetuses and what a fetus is, what an embryo is, when it's 4 weeks old, 6 weeks old, then we could have an honest discussion. But when religious people always run to the excuse of I'm being persecuted on one hand, and on the other hand, are not honest enough to just come out and say, look, I believe what I believe. Other people believe what they believe. Rachel Maddow believes what she believes because that's rooted in her belief system. None of us have 100% of the truth. We're all trying to get there. Let's be honest about the source of our belief system. Mine happens to be Roman Catholic. Mine happens to be people of praise. Deal with it. Then you could have a real discussion, and it would lift this country out of the mire of hypocrisy and lies. But for religious people to implement what their faith is, having hidden it during the hearing process, simply solidifies the cynicism in this country against the left, against the right, against everyone who doesn't come out and forthright declare their case and then act upon it. The problem with Coney Barrett and people like her is that she will act upon those beliefs, already intends on acting upon them, but is lying to the American people through her teeth under oath by saying she hasn't formed an opinion. Of course she has formed an opinion. That's why she has been part of the Federalist Society and these conservative groups behind the scenes as well as overt that have worked ceaselessly and tirelessly since Roe v. Wade shocked them into a state of wakefulness in terms of the culture war to place her and people like her on the bench. And in Donald Trump, they found their meal ticket. So let's quit all this messing around and pretending we don't all have philosophical and religious and moral presuppositions. Of course we do. Atheists like Chris Hitchens did. Daniel Dennett, all these other leaders on the new atheist movement, they have philosophical presuppositions they act on all the time. If one was up for a hearing with that belief system, they should be pressed on that belief system. They should be asked why they are part of an atheist movement that had people as part of that movement like Joseph Stalin and Mao Zedong. And how do they answer for the extremes of the atheist left? Why wouldn't we ask them those questions if we're going to put them in charge of our lives? Let's have at it. What I hate about this process is the hypocrisy, the smarmy, two-faced hypocrisy of the religious right and the Republicans who want to cry that they're being persecuted when they've got a majority in the Senate ramming this through, having denied Barack Obama for 8 months the opportunity to do what they're trying to do in a matter of 10 days, only 2 weeks before an election. That's what stinks.
Yeah.
So let's criticize Amy Coney Barrett and invite her to stand up and claim her faith and defend it instead of this weasel words of I'm being persecuted, you're attacking me, blah, 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 blah.
We've even heard in this hearing attempts to expand the torture definition of religious freedom even further by some Senate Republicans. I wonder if the majority of Americans even realize that's part of what's going on this week and goes on every week in highly paid, ostensibly faith-based, tax-exempt think tanks across this country. Do Americans know what's happening?
No, I think we're very naive, and I think a lot of that is the media's fault precisely because they have been intimidated into keeping their mouths shut about the repercussions of some folks' religious beliefs. For instance, climate change denial based on an evangelical view of the imminent return of Jesus Christ, meaning that it doesn't matter if the oceans are rising. So this matters because national policy is pursued by people like Trump and corporate those with corporate agendas and the oil companies and others that only survive because of the support of people that for some rather wacky religious ideas don't believe that this matters. That's a very pertinent example. And so what we need to do is realize that when they talk about religious freedom, they're talking about the freedom to impose a belief system on folks, a good example being something that we know Amy Coney Barrett supports because she's written about it, and that is stripping the right of corporations to offer not just abortion coverage, but even contraceptive coverage to women if those companies somehow run afoul of the religious rights of their owners or majority shareholders who happen to hold those religious views. So I just have this to put to them really clearly. Do we have a nation of the rule of law, or are we going to tolerate a kind of a soft theocracy that says, well, if gay rights offend Christians, then in companies run by Christians, you don't have gay rights. You can be fired without cause. You can be fired from an evangelical university without cause if you're a teacher there and you're found to be a lesbian. we can strip you of the right to get coverage on our insurance plan for contraceptives if we're a Christian institution. And if you come and say, hey, but that's the law, they just say, hey, our religious freedom means we should be exempt. Well, guess what, folks? That's the exact argument that the slaveholding South used and their preachers preached from the pulpit, that it was ordained by God and that somehow the North, in trying to abolish slavery and free slaves, was going against God's will. They claimed religious freedom for slavery. They claimed religious freedom for segregation. This is God's intent, separate races. And guess what? The U.S. law was rewritten and overrode their religious freedom. So you cannot say that you want the rule of law and order on one hand and you want religious exemptions on the other from that rule of law. That's nonsense. And again, it's a terrific hypocrisy on the part of these people.
Frank Schaeffer grew up an active member of a leading theocratic evangelical dynasty promoting a movement which he consciously and thoughtfully left behind. Frank's riveting books include an autobiography titled Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back, as well as the book Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God. Dark times, Frank, to be sure. Thank you for sharing with us again on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right.